Access number 27243, Mr. Don Reynolds, Reel 6. We're talking about when you visit Akureyri, which is in Iceland, and you said the weather was deteriorating.
It really got up into a real gale. And we were preparing to go out. And it was such a wind that to get out of the neck of the fjord, we actually went out astern. They couldn't satisfactorily turn round, I think, in the storm. They thought it was safer to go out stern first. And that was the first real storm that we experienced.
Now, what was it like in the destroyer? How did it affect you as a member of the crew?
I think the crew as a whole settled down extremely well. And we...
The storm.
The storm. you sort of have to take these things as they come. And whatever one's detail is, you get on and do it. But most of us in this sort of a circumstance, we're sort of doing our job, either looking out or... having just left the tanker and so on, we were sort of stowing ropes and hawsers and the rest of it. And then we sort of took shelter. That was the best thing to do. And we went out into the North Atlantic there and set off to pick up the convoy.
But you haven't really given us a picture of the storm. I mean, what, was it waves or wind or what was it? I mean, was the problem?
Yes, you get wind and waves together. The wind whips up the waves and they come thundering across. And you start bucking up and down. And the spray, of course, goes everywhere. And you're... whilst I mentioned earlier the warm weather clothing, we also had oilskins, of course, and they were absolutely essential.
Were you seasick at all?
I wasn't, fortunately. No, I wasn't. There were on board one or two people who were really seasick. There was a friend of mine who came from Essex, and he was very, very sick, and he was in the sick bay for several days during one of the storms. In fact, I rather think we did have an action whilst he was in the sick bay, which couldn't have been very pleasant.
So what happened next? Is it you're trying to make the rendezvous with the convoy in this storm?
Yes, eventually we sort of pick them up, and then we zigzag slowly, about 6 knots, which is neither here nor there. And if any of the boats stop, which occasionally they did, some of them were in very poor shape, and when they'd brought things across the Atlantic or whatever, a lot of them were ready to pack up. And occasionally one would have to turn back, not very frequently, but I think the record shows that the odd ship did actually break with the convoy and return to base. The activity when the convoy was really on the move was very much controlled by the weather. Because the big ships did have a job to maintain station and everything else. I think they were running with fairly small crews, as small as they could, and sometimes you began to wonder if anybody was really keeping a lookout on some of them. But they, as long as they kept going, you sort of knew that within 2 or 3 days you ought to reach your destination, short of some disaster. There's no easing off. I don't think the weather was too bad on that first convoy. We got into the Kola Inlet, and went along to the harbour near Poliano, and the convoy, of course, carried on up into Murmansk.
But you stayed at Poliano?
Yes, I think that's probably where we would say we were.
And what happened then? I mean, would you get ashore at all?
I don't remember going ashore on that first trip. I think we virtually turned round pretty quickly and started back.
Anything happened on the return convoy?
On the return convoy, which was 55A, we left Kola on the 22nd. And we quite expected to
of
be...
November?
Of December.
December, right.
December. And we quite expected we might be back in Scapa Flow for the end of the year, but when we were part way round the North Cape, the news leaked out that they suggested that the Scharnhorst was at sea, and that of course sparked everything off. People began to hope, I suppose, that we would be lucky to catch them, because the Scharnhorst was one of the boats that everybody wanted to finish. She caused endless trouble, and it was because she was in Norwegian waters that the convoys were having to be so well protected. But when the fleet was told that she was at sea, so preparations were made, and speculation was rife as to which way she would be going and the rest of it, and the Admiralty and the people on the different boats were all sorting out what was going to be the best approach, how to catch her and all the rest of it. And we were detached from the convoy that we were escorting and added to a cruiser squadron.
Now, was that just you, or was it the whole of your group?
I think it was probably four of us. We became a separate section and joined the other convoy protection group, all the shadowing cruisers. And it's only when something like this happens, and particularly when you read about it afterwards, that you appreciate how many boats there were up in the Arctic. We'd got two, altogether we'd got two or three battleships and umpteen cruisers. And the people that we were with when we started on the chase of the Scharnhorst were the, I think, the Norfolk and the Sheffield, and was it the Belfast? But anyway, three of them.
So a cruiser squadron, anyway.
A cruiser squadron. We joined up with them. And when the Scharnhorst was first sighted, it has to be appreciated that the day up there, we're now talking about the 24th of December, no, 25th of December, even Christmas Day. In those latitudes, there's only half light for about an hour or something during the day. It never really gets light, but you can see what's going on. And in the half light, the first shots were fired, I think somewhere about midday.
Now, where were you and your ship?
We were fairly close, I think, to the Norfolk. And the Norfolk did actually get hit. And one of the shells landed between the Norfolk and us. And that was when we knew it had started. And it was a matter then of all speed. Don't let them get away, sort of thing, and drive them towards this body if you can, because they've got more heavy armament than you've got, and this sort of thing. So that from then on it became a little bit of a chase, and the Scharnhorst, I think, had just about got the legs of us at the start, and it took quite a while with the seas coming over and the rest of it, and we were all closed up at our action stations. Of course, when you're at action stations, you're not able to get proper meals or anything of this sort. And this is when the cooks come into their own. When you know you're going to go to action stations, and it's the same for major operations such as should we say D-Day landings or anything of that sort, the Navy goes to the tiddy-oggy, the Cornish pasty, and that is something that personally I always look forward to. I always enjoy Cornish pasty, and I still do. But it's something that's got a good meaty content. It's got the pastry outside and the rest of it. And you do rely on that. And they produce those and hot chai or cocoa or whatever. And that's enough to keep you going.
So what happened? What happened as far as you could see?
I was, at this time, I was on X-Gun. And, of course, it's the forward-looking guns that get the shots in when you're chasing somebody. But we were able to see what was going on.
What could you see was happening?
Well, not a lot, except the fact that we were ploughing through tremendous, tumultuous seas, and keeping up a pretty good speed. The waves were coming over, and in those conditions, they tried to keep people off the upper deck and off the gun, the open guns, and so on. So that the chase continued one way or another through hours and hours. And I think time is very difficult to judge, because after that brief daylight period, everything's gone dark again. And the next time you're in action, after that first few shots, when tracer bullets, or tracer shells, I should say, get sprouting, going off across the horizon like star shell rocket, huge firework rockets, and so on. And I think there was one brief exchange at one stage, and then later on, of course, the big boys arrived, or the big boy, in this case the Duke of York, and she got four destroyers with her as well. So that the the night was absolutely brightened up by star shell. People putting a star shell behind a ship so that it was silhouetted and you could see what was going on. And they were talking, of course, in firing at several miles distance. But even then, you can pick up quite a lot when a ship is silhouetted.
Was it a dramatic sight?
It was. It was, really. And whilst you couldn't probably see the shells arriving, you could appreciate that some damage was being done. And we were involved in the chase for quite a long time, and it was quite a good thing, really, that we managed to chase her towards the Duke of York, because she did get slowed down eventually, and then the real massacre began, because once a ship is really badly hit, they slow down, and it's, they talk these days about the hounds after the fox and the rest of it, and the thing didn't have very much chance, although they were still firing until quite late in the operation.
Did you make a torpedo attack at all on the Virago?
We did. We were one of the later people that arrived, and we got a mention, all right, in the official reports. We supposedly fired 7 torpedoes, I think, and were given 3 hits.
But is this in the finishing off phase?
This is as much in the finishing off phase. They weren't in the slowing down phase, so I don't take as much credit perhaps as might be for it.
Any other memories of that night?
Not a lot. We sort of saw the smouldering wreck. We were on the outskirts. The odd boat or couple of boats had gone in and were lifting survivors. And there weren't very many of them. I have actually got a photograph here of the names and the signatures of the survivors. I think there are about 36 of them. And quite a few of those, I believe, are still alive and have been fairly recently at Scharnhorst reunions.
Did you pick any of them up yourselves?
Or? No, we didn't. No, we didn't.
So what happened next then?
Well, I think we returned to Russia after that. And then after a brief spell there, just probably refueling and this type of thing, we returned to Scapa Flow, and we got there on New Year's Day or New Year's Eve or New Year's Day.
So what happened next?
We set out again from Loch Hugh on the 12th of January, and this is the one where I'd got slightly
that's the one where
missed
you went
last time. We went to Akureyri. Now there were people on other boats that were allowed ashore in Akureyri, and they were welcomed in the shops, I think, but the Icelanders weren't terribly friendly. I don't say they were pro-German, but they weren't pro-us anyway. They were trying, I think, to be neutral, perhaps. But some people had been ashore, and we set off from Akureyri when the when our convoy had arrived. And
now, which convoy is this?
I think this will be 56A, JW 56A. And the convoy we fought through, and the weather, part of the time when we were in the first days of that convoy, the weather was very bad, and then it cooled down a bit, and we went. I'm just trying to sort out where we are. We sailed. Yes, we went to Kola with the convoy. And then turned round pretty well again and joined another convoy. This was one of the things. Some of the boats were changed from one convoy to another, so that we were guarding two convoys at any one time, almost, to try and keep the U-boats down. And it was on the convoy that left Kola on the 29th of January that we were at sea, and the sea was an absolute flat calm, and we had the best display of northern lights that you could ever wish to see. At one stage we were going along the very edge of the ice floe so that we could tell how cold it was. The night was bitter, and we'd been told that there were several submarines in the area. We were going along fairly fast. One or two of us were out doing a special run well wide of the convoy to try and keep the submarines out, when there was a tremendous thump at the back of us, and I personally thought, or we thought, that some depth charges that we had set off had actually caught a submarine. But in fact, we were told later that it was one of the NAT acoustic torpedoes, probably, that had been detonated. And had it not been, of course, we would have lost our stern. But within a very few minutes of that, our flotilla leader got hit. We were going along at a fairly cracking speed when we had the call on the intercom to the guns to prepare carley raft and scrambling nets. And we thought that we were going to be picking up German submariners. But instead we found that we were going alongside our flotilla leader, the Hardy, which had been lost.
Do you know the date that Hardy was sunk?
The 30th. 30th of January. Her stern was blown off, and she was down really badly by the stern, and she had got a couple of Carley floats out, and there were people already in the water, and we went alongside her port side and put out our hawsers, steel hawsers, and ropes as well, and we got the bows fairly tight together. But her bow, due to the weight of the stern, her bow was going up and down. And whilst we at the rear, I was still on X-gun and therefore involved in the action down at the stern, we were over the side, down the scrambling nets, trying to pull people inboard. And they were pretty cold, and they found it difficult to hold on to any ropes or anything else after just an odd minute in the water. It was very, very difficult to haul somebody inboard when you were down there and you weren't too warm yourself. But there were people paddling round in the Carly rafts trying to lift other people into them and so on. And we did our best to keep their spirits up. Well, now the boat, as I say, was going up and down. Her boat, her bow was going up and down. And as it was slowly tugging two ships together, the boats were going further apart at the stern, and a couple of the steel wires, snapped. And you can imagine the tremendous pressure. When they snapped, they whipped along, and there were more than one person virtually chopped in half. But whilst we were busy doing this, other people had been jumping from the bow to our bow. And I don't know how many we got across, but quite a few. And eventually, her bow came down on ours and sheared off the first, I would say, about 6 feet. Did tremendous damage to it. It crumpled it if it didn't knock it off. And this meant that they decided that Virago should leave the side of Hardy, and Venus, one of the other boats that had been going round keeping the submarine down, would come alongside, and that's what she did. And she took off a lot more of the crew, and whilst this was going on, I did actually see a submarine on the surface, and we weren't in a position to do much about it. And due to the Venus and the rest of them being about, she did submerge, but we had to be so careful there as a sitting duck that it wouldn't have been very clever to have got hit while you're trying to help somebody else. But we were then sent on to Kola, and we went up there slowly because of the bow, but I think with the weather being fairly calm, we didn't make too bad a trip of it. The Venus was then, having picked up all that were available for picking up, she was detailed to sink the Hardy. They had thought it was too badly damaged to be towed away and brought back for repairs. I always thought it was an unfortunate thing that that her crew appeared to have been on I forget what we call it. Anyway, part of the crew stood down, because there were rather more people in the after area that got killed when the torpedo hit than there might otherwise have been.